I'm Karen Hartglass, and you are listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today when we get to talk about my favorite subject, food, and everything that is involved with our food choices today. We've got a great topic today. We're going to be talking about food policy, obesity, and healthy school food. My guest is Michelle McCabe. She is a research assistant at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. She works with Roberta Friedman, Director of Public Policy, to research and create policy briefs and maintain the legislative updates. Michelle advocates for a healthy school food environment in her town. She is in her second term as chair of the Fuel for Learning Partnership, a PTA Council Standing Committee that serves on the Wellness Coalition, organizes educational events around nutrition and local food, and seeks to improve school lunches and school food policy. Michelle received her bachelor's degree from Vassar College and her master's degree from the University of Texas, Austin, both in art history. Welcome to It's All About Food, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, this is a really heavy topic, no pun intended. Those things just come out, and I never realize what I'm saying. But we have such a problem today, and it is very complicated. So many things are connected to so many other things, it almost seems impossible to solve.
No, certainly. The childhood obesity epidemic is, there are many factors involved, and certainly no one solution is going to fix the problem. It has to be addressed in multiple ways and in multiple environments.
Yeah,
and school is clearly one of those.
School is, it's so important. So we have the government, and they have their policies. Some of them are good, and some of them are not so good. We have the media that's promoting us to consume all kinds of things. A few of them are good. Most of them, I think, are not so good. We have parents who are typically both working, big schedules, overwhelmed, not eating well themselves, let alone knowing. Somehow I don't know if humans ever really knew what was right to eat, but we're certainly very confused now. And then the schools are struggling just with their own education policies, and then they have to feed children. It's just, and then there's this profit motive kind of hovering over everything. And it just makes it so overwhelming.
Yes, it's funny that we're finding ourselves in a situation where the easiest, convenient, and least expensive way to eat is unfortunately also the one that puts our health most at risk and leads to many health problems. You know, some are connected with obesity and some are not. And it's very overwhelming to consider how are we going to change an entire culture, really, that we've become around food, and how do we change that environment where the easy, the least expensive, and the most convenient choices are also the healthiest ones? And
well,
that is the subject of a lot
yeah.
of the work that is being done by the Rudd Center.
Well, it's interesting because you chose a number of words there that I think are worth talking about. One is easy, and the
mm-hmm.
other is least expensive. And I think there's a lot of debate around those words, because what some people think is easy in terms of convenience foods or grabbing things, if they thought a little bit more about it, what goes into those foods to get them so that they're just accessible is not very easy at all. There's a lot
That's
of manufacturing
true.
And a lot of people involved to package foods and get them so that we can just pop them in a microwave. And it may not be environmentally friendly, and certainly may not be healthy. And then this expense thing is so connected to our government, our governmental policies, making some foods more affordable and other foods not.
Yes, it's true. And in a way, it's falsely inexpensive, because
yeah.
what makes it inexpensive is not ultimately sustainable. And I think, too, there is a misperception of cost as well, because there have been studies that show that actually buying whole foods and fresh foods is not more expensive than buying prepackaged, pre-prepared foods. I mean, most of us know that to prepare a meal at home, for example, is less expensive than to buy one out at a restaurant or even a fast food place.
Yeah, there's nothing cheaper than beans and rice.
That's exactly right.
I mean, really.
Ew.
Now, maybe we want to try something different than rice because now we're hearing about arsenic in rice, but I digress.
I know. It just doesn't end, does it?
There's, you know, every food has a story, I like to say, and not always a good one. Okay, so you've got a lot of challenges. What is the Rudd Center focusing on? What are some of the things that you're doing?
We're focusing on a lot of different directions, most of it trying to equal the balance that we just described, looking to make it easier and affordable to make those healthy choices, and to also try to address the sort of, like I said, the false inexpense of certain things. Like one of the initiatives that is being studied by the Rudd Center is a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages,
mm-hmm.
Because that particular food product has been shown to have a very clear link to a lot of health problems and obesity. Unlike other food products, there is no nutritional value in sugar-sweetened beverages, and we are just simply drinking a lot of them. And we don't have the mechanisms biologically to be able to feel full. So in other words, you may drink hundreds of calories of a beverage, but it's not the same as eating 100 calories of something else where
right.
you might feel full and then you're ready to stop. That mechanism doesn't work as well with liquid beverages.
It seems like a great place to start. And here in New York City, of course, Mayor Bloomberg has been working on taxing our he wanted to tax, and that didn't work out. And then now he's trying to avoid the extra large sizes of beverages, and he's getting a lot of pushback from that.
Yes, it's difficult because, I think as Americans like to rely on our own choices to determine what we're going to buy or consume. But I think part of the interesting question here is, you're looking at someone who's trying to make those choices smaller, but there are also people that are actually interfering with our judgment by making the portions larger.
That's such an important point.
Yes, and so, people, there have been many studies that show that, people will consume what's in front of them. And so, your choice is being taken away if everything that's being presented to you is extra large as well, or you're being persuaded by other factors like the value meal, for example, or where the products are placed in the grocery store. I mean, they really are kind of working against your personal choice. And so this is just someone trying to do the same thing but for the benefit of your health. So,
there's a lot of education and empowerment that needs to happen where people recognize that they're being manipulated.
Yes, or just how nice it would be to be able to walk into a store or to go to a restaurant and feel comfortable that the choices that you're being presented with are not only tasty but also aren't going to jeopardize your health in any significant way. And I think that's one of the great things about the school environment as,
mm-hmm.
One of those places where we really can make a big difference. And it's both, and that environment should be, especially because we're dealing with children who are still developing, who are learning about choices and learning about what is appropriate to eat, that those places be sort of those utopian environments where neither the parents nor the students nor the staff have to even worry. They know that what's being put in front of the kids is really good, both really good for them
concept.
And really good to taste.
What,
I know.
What
that
a concept. It's so obvious that if we walked into a place and we were hungry and it only had food that was good for us, we would find something that would satisfy us.
Absolutely.
And it's really a no-brainer, and yet we don't seem to get there. But also, I'm sure you're up on some of these. There have been some articles in the news lately and some activity going on that is just kind of nutty. So there's been this fight, I guess, against the No Hungry Kids Act. I'm backtracking. The USDA put out some guidelines a couple of years ago about maximum calories of dishes for meals in schools.
Yes.
And you know, sometimes we try and solve problems and then we make more problems. We don't, I don't know, we don't regulate. I have a personal feeling, and I guess it's hard for schools, but I don't think we should be focusing on calories. But that's another story.
I think that, you know, what's interesting about the situation that's going on right now with the calorie caps, there have always been calorie minimums. These first, the school food regulation, you know, isn't actually, the idea of it isn't new, and this is just a revamping of them that occurred with that Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010. But and there were always calorie minimums because the program was initially developed to help with malnutrition in our country. And you know, the calorie caps are actually quite generous, and it has been shown that the kids are actually calorie-wise getting more than what they had been getting previously before the regulate. Yes, ironically. But and it's a lot, especially looking, if you're looking strictly at the high school, it's quite a lot of calories. I think what the schools are having more difficulty with are really the grain and protein, how much they're allowed to be giving in those particular areas of the lunch program. And I agree that it is complicated and it is difficult. I think that we really need to commend food service directors for, you know, working with these guidelines and trying to give the kids with very limited funds, you know, the best meals that they can. I think that a lot of the hoopla over it, some of it is just about misinformation and misunderstanding than an actual reflection of what's going on.
What about, I read another article where, okay, there are more fruits and vegetables being offered, but basically kids are just throwing them in the trash.
I'm so glad you brought that up because it's been causing a bit of consternation, I think, those articles, simply because we really don't know what's being thrown away. We do plate waste studies here at the Red Center, and they're very, very involved, as you can imagine. I mean, to really understand what's being thrown away, you basically have to not only dig in the trash, but you have to weigh things. And what they have found is that people are predisposed, especially if they're not doing an actual research study on plate waste, they are predisposed to see what they are expecting to see in the garbage. So, for example, there was a study that was done where they were looking at flavored milk versus plain milk that was being consumed in a given school. And even the researchers themselves were assuming that, you know, it was probable that the flavored milk was being consumed while the plain milk wasn't. And what they found, they actually measured. They poured out the actual milk. You can imagine what a messy job this is. The students were consuming and throwing away the exact same amount of both. There really wasn't a difference. And I think the point, one of the sort of tangential points that was made in this, was that people are going to see what they're expecting to see. If folks are expecting to see fruits and vegetables in the trash, and sometimes for good reason, you know, they don't want them to be in the trash. They're not looking to, you know, blow the lid off of anything, but they're actually just concerned. They will see fruits and vegetables in the trash. And a lot of the information that's going around in the press isn't based on someone actually doing a measurement. And also, as far as I know, I don't know what studies are out there that was looking at this before the regulation compare. And plus, there are a lot of other factors, too. I mean, you can imagine that it depends on what fruits and vegetables are being served. I know that, you know, sometimes they'll get something fresh and delicious and that kids really like, and sometimes it could be coming out of a can and it's just not very appealing.
Yeah.
So there's so many different factors that jumping to a conclusion, unfortunately, I think, undermines what the point is, which is kids need to eat more fruits and vegetables. And I can't imagine that people don't want kids to be eating more fruits and vegetables. At least I hope not. So it's almost, it's too bad because it's not, you know, it's October,
mm-hmm.
and anyone who has children knows that it takes a while for people to get, kids in particular, to get used to new things and
yeah.
get used to new foods. And rather than, you know, getting all excited that things have not worked out or have failed, I think we need to recognize that things take time and we need to be supportive and then make an actual evaluation that's valid.
But that needs to be incorporated in any plan. And every time I read about these different programs, I feel it seems like it isn't. And it's well known in the food service, food system establishment, you need to introduce a product numerous times in happy environments for people to
yes.
ultimately request them.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think that there are plenty of school districts, most of them, I'm sure, unsung heroes
mm-hmm.
quietly
yeah.
working where they're working that are doing a lot of great things to ensure that the food that they're making is being eaten and to make students in particular part of the process. There are districts that, for example, will do sampling. They are districts who will have committees that students are actually a part of. And they work with the food service directors on menus, and they taste. They do tastings as well. Those are the situations that aren't necessarily getting the widespread press as more, I don't know, as the garbage cans. For
right.
you know, there are places that really are doing a great job trying to ensure that the kids like the food and that it's healthy, not just, well, the kids like chicken nuggets, for example, so that's what we're serving. You know, there are districts that are working to get kids to enjoy better-for-you foods.
Right. Education is so important. We know that. And the schools are struggling so much with their curriculums and programs and effectiveness. But kids need to learn about food, why, what's good for us, why it's good for us, where it comes from, how it's made. So many people have no idea where their food comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I know one 13-year-old who was telling me he's reading Chew on This by Eric Schlosser in,
mm-hmm.
in his school, and you know they're learning about a lot of heavy things that I think it's important kids know about things like factory farming and where their food comes from. You know, hamburgers don't grow on hamburger patches.
Right.
yeah, and when they're educated, they're more empowered to make the right choices.
Yes, and sometimes actually it's the children that are coming home and educating the parents,
mm-hmm.
myself included, and I think that's sometimes, you know, a really wonderful way that people learn. You know, they go, I remember my youngest was in a preschool where they spent a whole week tasting different vegetables. And it was both an exercise in food and nutrition, but it was also a math exercise because they were graphing and charting. But what was great was when parents picked the children up, there was a chart hanging on the front door, and I learned that my son, for example, really loved red peppers. I had no idea.
I was just going to mention red peppers. They're like candy.
Mm-hmm. They really are. They're delicious. And it was so great for me as a parent. You know, it's not as though, I try to put different things in front of them. But here, he tried it in a new environment. He may have liked it more because of the fact that other kids were enjoying it, and he was doing it at school, and it wasn't his, you know, mom telling him to eat everything on his plate. But it was a great opportunity for both of us to learn something.
It's interesting that parents don't realize how often their own opinions affect their children, and so if a parent doesn't like a food and doesn't include it or sees it serves and kind of scrunches up their nose,
yeah.
the kid feels the same way, unfortunately. So it's great that they have an opportunity to try new foods outside of the parental atmosphere. Allergies
mm-hmm.
is another piece of this very complicated problem. And more of us are allergic or sensitive to different foods, children, to the point where it can be fatal sometimes.
Yes. And I know that's very difficult for many schools and cafeterias to accommodate. you know, it is definitely a challenge that's becoming more prevalent.
How did we get to this place? Is this something new, or we just, you know, did humans always have these allergies, or is it because we have so many new Frankenfoods and manufactured foods? Do you have any idea what the cause is?
Well, I know that this is outside, certainly, of our scope of research, and I don't know, and I know that there are people that are working on it. You know, for me, I'm looking at it from the exact same level of expertise, I imagine, as you are, mm-hmm. in the sense that I don't know, but it does seem certainly like there are more children and adults who are exhibiting certain issues and allergic reactions to food. There's no question about it. You know, I think there are a lot of, I'm sure that there are a lot of things going on with our health that are connected with our food that we don't even know about yet.
Right.
And I imagine now that people are really focusing on it, we're going to learn a lot more. Because, you know, I imagine some of the things that are being used, it's not as though people have done any testing on them. So, you know, we don't know.
Yeah. We don't test enough on so many things. And then once they're out in the food supply, it's kind of hard to isolate which ones are causing a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you are involved in policy and legislative updates. How difficult is it working with the government to make change?
Well, we work mostly, we work more as an educational provider for legislators or other folks working in government. I mean, what the Red Center does is focuses the research we do in such a way that it can actually, that it's actionable in the form of policy. And so, for example, if we go back to sugar sweetened beverage taxes, our economist here at the Red Center created a tax revenue calculator, for example, that could show how much money a state could make were they to levy an excise tax. They, you know, model certain things to see if consumption of sugar sweetened beverages would decrease were a tax to be put in place. So what we do here is really provide the science to support the change that can occur in government. For me, we have a tool that's available on our website that is a database of legislation that's related to food policy and obesity. And for me, it's just interesting to see how difficult it is just for things to pass.
Yeah.
You see hundreds of bills introduced, and so few of them actually make it through. That it's a slow process. But I think what is wonderful when it does happen is that when something is a policy, then it has the potential of influencing so many people and having a positive effect, excuse me, for many people for many years. And I think as slow as it is, it's a positive way of making positive change.
There have been a number of books out lately about the French culture and bringing up children with the French culture and how much better they eat. And I'm not sure if I agree with it or not. I lived in the south of France for 4 years, and I've seen children and their eating habits. They seem to be a lot better than here in America. Are you familiar with any of those, and do you have any feeling about how our culture versus other cultures affects our eating habits?
This is, again, speaking as a person, as a researcher, I am familiar with that, and with the books that have been not only on food but also on parenting. I don't know if you've seen, mm-hmm. there's a whole book on how French parents parent compared to Americans. I think we definitely do have a different relationship with food. There's no question about it. You know, having spent some time in Europe, I mean, even just how they spend their meals is just so incredibly different from ours, and of course they have, you know, a longer tradition,
culture. I've heard we only get 10 minutes for kids to eat in some schools.
Oh, I know. If that is, I have to say, that is a huge, huge problem that is very concerning to many parents, myself included, mm-hmm. and one that is it's very difficult to come up with how to solve it. I mean, the staff and teachers at schools today are so strapped to get all of the curriculum taught. I know instructional time is at such a premium that it's hard to figure out where in the day they can carve out more time for lunch.
Yeah, oh gosh.
But kids are really rushing through it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You're involved with your PTA Council Standing Committee on the Fuel for Learning Partnership. It's so important when parents get involved, and the PTA can really be a powerful place to make change in individual schools.
Absolutely, absolutely, especially when the PTA and parents are working in partnership with food service and staff. It's phenomenal the amount of change that can take place, and it's very important for them to work closely together. And that's what we have found. And the more educated a parent is on what the issues that a food service director, for example, is dealing with, it's so much easier to come up with a plan. And also the parents are there to build support for it. You know, again, if we go back to what you had mentioned with the press and all of the backlash that's occurring with the new nutrition standards, it's so important that the community stands behind them. And PTA and PTO and other parent organizations are, as you can imagine, poised to be able to provide that support, because ultimately we want the students eating it. And so it's been a real honor and privilege to be able to have worked closely with our school administrators through PTA, where I live and my children go to school, and try to make a difference.
You have how many children?
Three. Yes, three boys. They're all in elementary school.
Oh, goodness. And are they good eaters?
You know what? Actually, they pretty much are. They are good eaters. It's each of them, they don't all like the same things, but there are certain, fruits and vegetables and things that they all, each of them like. And I think they're also pretty typical as well. You know, they're not so, but they are good eaters, and I'm very lucky that way, because it's difficult when you're struggling and you just want your child to eat something.
Right.
They're on their way to school, and you're practically begging them just to put anything in their mouth, and I can see why. It ends up being very stressful. And also, when you had brought up the point about, two parents working, and certainly if dinner time, for example, is one of the few times that everybody's together, I can understand why nobody wants it to be a battleground over who's eating their spinach or not.
Right. Or even when you're tired, to have to think about, okay, what am I going to start making?
Oh, yes. It's a huge challenge, and it's a huge challenge. I mean, I'm personally, as you can imagine, very interested in all of this, and I work very hard to serve the kind of food that I want due to my family, but I can't honestly imagine many people having that level of diligence, because it's just too hard. It's very time-consuming.
Yeah.
It's very time-consuming, and so...
I like to come up with ways to help people so that they can prep a lot of things on the day off, work with kids, and make different things that they might freeze and have along the week. And there are ways to organize things and do some time-saving steps. But it requires effort. It requires education, and it requires practice, and it requires a want.
Yes. Yes. I mean, the truth is, at the end of the time, once you get into the groove, I think it becomes a lot easier.
Absolutely.
But it is a learning curve that is hard. But and also, there are so many great technological advances that help, like a slow cooker.
Mm-hmm.
I rely on heavily, and actually, I just started using a bread maker.
Right.
The bread machine.
There you go. Yep.
It's been really great, and so it's pretty fail-safe, and that's been a lot of fun. But it does make things a lot easier once you can leverage some basic kitchen equipment.
That's right. There's a lot of things that can make things easier where you're making fresh, whole, minimally processed, very clean, healthy food that tastes good.
Right.
Michelle, thank you very much
thank
for joining
so much
me on It's All About Food. I'm really glad you're doing the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, and thank you so much for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Please visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my nonprofit website where you can find lots of healthy, delicious recipes. So many of them are easy and will help you in your journey to eating better for you and your family. We'll be right back with the second part of the show. Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and we're back. You're listening to It's All About Food, and I want to bring on my next guest, Noam Moore. He is a physicist and at Queens College with degrees from Yale University and the University of Pennsylvania. He has worked on global warming campaigns for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group and EarthSave International, publishing a number of reports on climate change, including a new global warming strategy, flirting with disaster, pumping up the price, and storm warning. Welcome back to It's All About Food, Noam.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
You know, I wanted to talk about climate change and global warming and a number of other things, but tell me, is the planet really warming up? I'm freezing right now. The weather is horrible in New York City. It's snowing and wet. It's kind of hard to believe that things are getting hot.
Well, it does tend to cool down in the winter. That is not going to change due to global warming. But the trends are quite striking that year after year, we see the trends of warming the planet, which is exactly what we'd expect as we keep pumping out these global warming gases into the atmosphere. Right now, this October, which is may seem cold where you are, is the fifth warmest on record that we've ever seen.
Really?
Almost all the top 10 warmest years we've seen on record are the years of this past decade.
Gosh, it's not feeling warm right now, but I believe you.
Yeah, it's quite striking when you look at the overall trends.
And what does that mean when the Earth is warming? Why is it alarming?
When the planet warms, this causes a great number of environmental changes to the climate, which affect us in many ways. The way that most people think about when they hear global warming is rising sea levels, and that's because water expands when it's hot, and so the sea will rise and flood the coastal areas. But that is only the tip of the iceberg. We should expect to
see... No pun intended.
Yes, exactly. That really was a not intended. We expect to see increases in many types of extreme weather as all this extra energy goes into the weather cycles. For example, we expect to see a lot more of the kind of droughts that we've been seeing across the United States this year, a lot more heat waves, ironically also a lot more downpours as a when it does rain, there's more moisture in the air. We expect to see hurricanes be stronger, and we've seen some of the effects of hurricanes just this past year, and we're expecting more of them as the planet heats up. Also expect more disease, because the ranges of tropical diseases will spread as the planet gets warmer. And also a lot of destruction of biodiversity and habitats, because as the climate changes, the habitats are also changing for the plants and animals that are in our natural environment, and they will not be able to keep up with these rapid changes. So
it's really hard to believe. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is not something minor. I mean, this is something that will impact us. More hurricanes and droughts have a severe economic impact on us, but especially on countries that are less able to deal with it than the United States is. In poorer countries, this means starvation, this means water shortages, this means all the terrible things that come as a result of that, famine, disease, war. It's really a serious global crisis.
sure, you know, we just went through Hurricane Sandy, and I know that it impacted you personally with where you were living.
That it did.
And certainly here in New York, we were very focused on what was going on in New York. But then I read in Haiti, just as you mentioned, in countries that are not as developed as we are, Haiti has been hit with so many things over the last, well, for a very long time. First, they've been abused and exploited by so many different countries, ravaged, and then with earthquakes, and they were severely hit by Hurricane Sandy.
Yes. And Hurricane Sandy is not the only hurricane this season, which has brought a lot of damage to countries down there.
Right.
It's really sad.
It seems hard to believe, but if we're paying attention, you can even see the impact of the change in the climate. If you know when local birds are normally nesting or when things normally bloom and fade, those things are changing.
If you're not paying attention, it's easy to think, I don't notice the difference. This doesn't matter to me. There are hurricanes anyway. But when you look at the data, we're seeing increases in the strength of hurricanes. We're seeing increases in warming seasons. We're seeing this year, we saw a record melting of Arctic ice. Ice cover was in the Arctic Ocean was the smallest it's ever been as far as we know. I mean, it's really a severe trend. And you might think, who cares about Arctic ice? That's far away. But that Arctic ice reflects light off the surface of the Earth, keeping the Earth cool. As that melts, we'll have less cooling of the Earth, which will accelerate the warming in a runaway process. More warming, less ice, more warming. And we'll reach a tipping point from which there is no coming back.
So do we have really any idea of the time frame for what we think is going to happen?
Yes. Well, in the example of Arctic ice in particular, this is happening faster than the models expected.
That's wonderful.
some predict that we'll be ice-free by as soon as 2020, certainly by the middle of the century. So it's something that is happening fast, and it's something that what we're seeing today is only the beginning. It's only the start of the trend. As temperatures continue to rise, we will see the problems pile on further and further. So the problems we're seeing now should be simply a warning of much worse things to come if we don't do anything about it. That should be our focus. What can we do? Increasingly, these weather disasters are not acts of God. They're things that we are having an influence over. And we need to really think about what we can do before we create a climate for the entire planet, which is a serious issue.
Well, I certainly want to talk about what we can do, and that's why I brought you on. But just before we do that, I'm kind of nervously alarmed right now. So you said that there are some that have said that in 7 years we may be ice free.
Yes. For example, this
2020,
year,
that's 7 years away. I mean, it sounds like a long time from now, but it's not.
This year, the Arctic ice fell to 24% of the ocean. The previous record was 29%. So that's 5% less than the previous record. This is something that's changing rapidly. And that's the thing. Not all these things are gradual. Sometimes we reach a tipping point where things just run away from themselves. If the Greenland ice pack collapses, it'll collapse very quickly, and all that water will flow into the ocean, and we'll see a rapid rise in sea levels.
Have there been predictions about where that water will go, like what will be going under? Should I be moving? Should you be moving?
Well, it depends where you live, of course. We see when storms happen and sea levels rise a little or there are storm surges, we see all these areas that get severely damaged. So there's a lot of people who are in the danger zone where this will have a severe impact on them. I mean, there are areas like, for example, Florida. Most of Florida is just a little bit above sea level. So a rise in sea level will flood a lot of Florida. And there are other places where it will have less of an effect. So it depends.
Oh, goody. Okay. So we need to talk about what we can do. And the good thing about Hurricane Sandy is Mayor Bloomberg put global warming in the forefront. He acknowledged it. Governor Cuomo acknowledged global warming, that it's happening, that it's real, that it's not some made-up fantasy, and that we need to be doing things about it. But I don't think those guys are talking about what you're talking about we need to do.
Well, it's shocking that some people still don't believe in global warming, but that belief is totally without scientific basis. Among climate scientists, there's no debate going on about whether this is happening. It's truly essentially unanimous that this is going on and that humans are causing it. So it's important to realize that this is something that we're doing, and that if we're going to do something about it, it's our actions that we need to change.
Okay, I'm a believer.
And there's many things we can do to reduce our own effect on the environment, our own environmental footprint. When we drive cars, they emit carbon dioxide, which warms the earth. When we use power, that also emits carbon dioxide, which warms the earth. And these are kind of the areas that most people are familiar with. But it is one area that I really like to stress, because people don't think about it, but it is the most powerful thing we can do, is the impact of our diet. What we eat has by far the largest impact on the climate of the things that we do personally. Simply by choosing more environmentally friendly products at mealtime every day, we can help reduce the global warming problem. And
we should have labels on food that say this is a low carbon footprint food.
Well, that would be ideal. But if you don't have labels, there's easy rules of thumb, because the main cause of the problem is animal agriculture. The animals
again.
We raise for food, and the forests we destroy to create land for those animals to graze and to grow crops for those animals. And when we grow far more crops for animals than we do for humans, all of this is extremely energy intensive. It takes 10 times as much energy to create a calorie of animal protein as a calorie of plant protein. So this is a severe source of our energy use in this country, and it's the number one place where we can make changes that will impact positively on the global warming problem.
I was just curious about something. Now, there's a lot of things wrong with animal agriculture, and there's a lot of different pieces from animal agriculture that add to the global warming picture. And one piece is the destruction of the rainforest, where parts of the rainforest are being plowed away, hazed away, destroyed in order to make farmland either to grow soybeans to feed cattle or to graze cattle. And that's one piece of it, because when the rainforest goes away, it can't suck in the CO2 that we're putting in the atmosphere and clean it up and make oxygen. And also when those trees are removed from the rainforest, all of that carbon that they've been collecting goes up into the air, and it adds more carbon to the atmosphere. So it's really a bad thing. My question is, I'm not sure if you can address it, is we've been getting a lot of focus these days on palm oil and how palm trees are being grown and the rainforest is being destroyed in order to grow palm oil. And palm oil is used in lots of food, and it's used in lots of other products. And I've been trying to find out what percentage of the rainforest is being destroyed for palm oil and what's being destroyed for cattle production. I've been having a hard time finding those numbers. But I'm getting a feeling that it's a little distracting, because more focus lately has been going towards palm oil, so that people don't talk about giving up their meat.
I don't know what the numbers are from palm oil, but it's definitely far less than for meat. If you look at the Amazon rainforest, the area that was destroyed since 1970, 90% of that area is now being used for raising animals for food. So there's no comparison with palm oil. If you look at the surface of the earth, about a third of the land surface of the earth right now is being used to raise animals for food. It's just extraordinary. This is by far the biggest impact upon the environment, not just with global warming. Of course, when you use so much resources and so much land on this one industry, it's also a top cause of water pollution, of loss of biodiversity, of air pollution, of soil erosion, and basically every environmental issue is tied in with this. But it's definitely at the top of the list for global warming. And it's not just that the severe energy use, and as you said, the destruction of rainforests, which get burned releasing huge amounts of carbon dioxide. It also is an enormous source of methane, which people might be less familiar with, but it's a major global warming gas because even though it's produced in smaller quantities, it's 25 times more powerful than CO2 at warming the earth. And the number one source of methane is animal agriculture. Mm-hmm. It comes from the animals, their digestive processes. It comes from the huge amounts of manure they produce. I mean, animals, for animal agriculture in the U.S., produce 100 billion gallons per day of, sorry, 100, sorry, I got that number off, 100,000 pounds per second of manure.
It's a lot of poop.
All the time. Yeah, and these end up, they don't go into, there's nowhere to put them. They just end up in huge lagoons where the anaerobic activity emits methane into the atmosphere.
That's the craziest thing. So human waste is treated, and yet we're producing far more amounts of animal waste, and it's not treated. It's just piled higher and deeper.
So yeah, well over 100 times as much as humans produce. Right?
It's crazy. It's very crazy. And why we're not doing more about it. And then to add to the problem, there have been some numbers showing that people are eating a little less meat in the United States.
Well, that's the good news. People are taking these messages to heart, and people have been reducing their consumption of meat and other animal products.
But they're eating more in India and China.
Right.
And there are more people there, so there's potential for it really to, I mean, it's already out of hand, but to get even more out of hand.
Yeah, people are looking at increases of five times in the next 50 years, current trends. But we can only change that one person at a time, right? If we start improving things in the U.S., which is, we're 4% of the population, but we emit 25% of the global warming gases, then we take the lead and the rest of the world will be able to follow.
Somewhere. Do you think people are more open to this message now about animal agriculture and global warming? I'm not hearing it.
The number of people who say in polls that they take this problem seriously has been on the rise, so I definitely believe it. And you do see more and more vegetarian alternatives in supermarkets, not just for vegetarians, for people who are trying to cut down on meat. As you pointed out, people are eating less and less meat. Every year after year, the amount of meat each person consumes is going down. So it is something that is catching people's attention. It is making a difference.
You probably were aware back in 2006 when the Food and Agriculture Organization, a part of the United Nations, put out a report called Longhorn's Long Shadow. Is that what it was called?
Livestock's Long Shadow.
Livestock's Long Shadow, and it talked about how 18% of human-induced greenhouse gas emissions are caused by animal agriculture. And we were all excited when that came out. And then in the World Watch magazine, Goodland and Jeff Anhang wrote an article, and they said that report was off and that over 50% of human-induced greenhouse gases are caused by animal agriculture. And there's been a lot of discussion about this, but it looks like actually the United Nations and the Food and Agricultural Organization is kind of backtracking a little and working more towards this, quote, sustainable animal agriculture rather than encouraging people to eat less meat.
I mean, that is, I think, an unfortunate political decision they made on what they think would be more effective. I think the key thing is to let people know what they can do, and rather than decide for themselves that, oh, people aren't going to eat less meat. People in the United States, people are eating less meat, and I think if people are educated about what they're doing, they'll make their intelligent decisions for themselves and for the planet, which they do care about. I mean, they do care about what's going to be left for their children. They do care. Nobody wants to see more hurricanes and more natural disasters and more disease. And if they know that simply eating healthier is going to have a real impact on the entire planet, I mean, that's an empowering message for anybody.
Are there any places to go where people can learn more about the connection between global warming and animal agriculture?
Sure, there are many places. EarthSave.org is a great site for connections between the environment and animal agriculture. And
that's where they can find your report.
That's true. That is where they can find my report. And really, what was once a new thing that many environmental groups didn't want to discuss so much because they were worried about telling people what they should and shouldn't do has now become mainstream. For example, Al Gore now promotes vegetarianism and says he himself eats very little meat.
It's because he sees how good Bill Clinton looks.
Yeah.
And he wants to lose some weight, maybe.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's the poster child for doing something about global warming.
Right.
And he, a formal cattle rancher, right? He is now promoting this. So it's really everywhere you look, if you look for it.
Well, that's really good to hear. I still hear, for the most part, people are talking about the future, talking about cleaner cars and cleaner factories and cleaner energy. And what you made important in that report that you wrote a few years back is that all of that stuff is good. All of that new technology is really good, but it's going to take a long time to cycle all that new stuff in so that it makes a significant difference. It's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of money. And we need to do something now, and this is where animal agriculture really comes into play, because we can make that difference now. Unfortunately, so many animals are born and killed in a very short amount of time, and as soon as the demand goes down, those animals will not be created.
That's right. And this is an area which is very powerful in addressing the problem. Like you said, it's something that anyone can do today. If someone wanted a more efficient car, that's something that's hard to go out and change today. You can, the next time you go to buy a car, you could look for something more fuel efficient. But what you eat, at every meal, you can make a difference. It's really that easy. If people wanted today to all cut out meat entirely from their diet, it would happen. I mean, it's really that simple if we simply want to.
So how do we get to our government officials to get this message to them so that they start talking more about it? And certainly it's important for every one of us as individuals to make this change, but I also think that those guys need to be talking more about it. It's just so hard for them to do anything really good.
It's difficult because the political process is very sensitive to some special interests. You may have heard in the news when the government promoted Meatless Mondays that the meat industry got really upset, and then they walked back on that. But if people make this an issue, that they make clear that this is an issue they care about, if they write to their legislator saying, you know, this is an important issue, we need to do something, we need to stop subsidizing these harmful industries and instead encouraging healthy, environmentally friendly types of diets and practices, then they will listen. I mean, ultimately, they listen to what they feel people care about. So it's really important to let our legislators know what we think.
Do you have an opportunity to talk to young people about this issue from time to time and see what their reaction is?
Young people are very interested in trying to make a difference. And that's one of the things that I hear from them all the time. And so when they hear this is a way they can make a difference, they are very, very open to the idea. They are looking for ways in which they can do something. particularly with environmental problems, you often feel like, you know, it's up to the government to fix, or for some corporation, right? If some factory is spewing toxic stuff, what can I do? It's the factory. But this is something which people are open to because it's something that they can do different that will help the problem.
It's really empowering, actually, to know that you can help rather than there's nothing you can do.
And it's not a small difference. It's a huge difference. The impact of animal agriculture is enormous, and that means the impact on our changes in diet is also enormous. I mean, methane causes so much more warming than carbon dioxide, which means that when we reduce the source of methane, we are pushing away the date in which we're causing some kind of permanent damage to the climate or causing some severe weather disaster. And that's something that we can do.
I don't think you mentioned this today, but one of the other things about methane, it's a lot more powerful than carbon dioxide, as you said. But one of the nice things about it is it cycles out a lot faster out of the atmosphere.
It does. It only stays in the atmosphere for 10 to 12 years, which means if we stopped producing, emitting methane today, then in 10 to 12 years, the methane that's already out there will be gone, and that will cool the Earth.
It's so unbelievable how simple it is if we could all just stop eating meat and eating plants. But what a beautiful place this world could be. There is hope, and it's all just up to us.
That's right.
And you know what? As I'm always saying, and it's the most delicious thing you could possibly do. There's the side effects are better health and better eating.
That's right. It's truly an example of a win-win.
Yep, all the way around. Noam, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. Stay warm, stay dry, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Okay. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and I want to remind you to visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's where all those yummy, delicious recipes are for you to help you, whether you're vegan or trending towards vegan or just want to eat more plant foods. We help you do that. Thanks for listening, and have a very delicious week. Bye-bye.